This is Emmett Patterson. I'm an intern with the LGBT Progress team at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Dylan Orr, Chief of Staff in the Office of Disability Employment Policy in the U.S. Department of Labor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Emmett. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also in the studio today, we have Allie Cannington, Youth Transitions Fellow with HSC Foundation in the National Council on Independent Living. Allie, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Emmett.
And on the phone, we have Kaite Davidson, who is the Social Innovation Coordinator at the Goldhirsch Foundation. Kaite, we're really excited to have you join us.
Thank you, Emmett. I'm excited to be here with you.
So just last month, the White House held its first ever forum on LGBT and disability issues. All three of you were speakers during the day. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience being part of the first discussion of LGBT people with disabilities in the White House? What did it mean for you to have a national platform to bring these experiences to light? Let's start with you, Allie.
Yeah, so the day at the White House was honestly a dream come true for me personally. The energy in the room was unreal. It was lively. It was filled with people who were so thoughtful and so committed to whether that be disability or LGBT or LGBT people with disabilities. And there was such a merge of those two communities in such a beautiful way. There was a wonderful balance of government officials, non-government organizations, and even artists and actors who were there. And what I personally loved the most was the fact that there were young people with disabilities and young LGBT folks, as well as our instrumental leaders who have been leading both movements for decades. And that, there was a real cross-generational conversation that took place. And for me, belonging to both communities, it meant the world. But what I remembered throughout the day was that it was such a privilege to be there. And I was constantly reflecting on who also wasn't able to be there and how it was that conversation and that event was incredible. But what happens next?
That's great. Thanks, Allie. Kaite, can you tell us a little bit about what that day meant for you?
Certainly. I mean, it was absolutely really powerful. So often people who are either LGBT are disabled are not disabled. So having an event that centers both individuals and identities at the center of those intersections was just truly monumental. And I remember sitting on stage and just thinking about all the transgender ancestors and people with disabilities who have advocated so that people with my identities and experiences would have a place at the table. And so for me, I was just grateful to be able to add to their work and push the movement forward and to increase representation and movement building in our nation's capital.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing. And last but not least, Dylan, do you want to tell us a little bit about your role in that day and kind of what it meant to you?
Well, I just want to echo Allie and Kaite's sentiments. Actually, Allie took the words out of my mouth. It really was a dream come true to hold a White House-level event bringing these communities and these issues together, especially right now and especially under this president. And I was incredibly inspired, and I could feel palpably the inspiration from others in the room during the conversation and then following the event. And it's really clear to me from the response to the event and others that I've participated in around these intersections that this area is just ripe for continued conversation and action.
So for people who weren't at the White House event, this might be the first time that they're ever hearing a discussion that unites the experiences of both LGBT people and people with disabilities. Dylan, you actually wrote a post for the White House blog called Same Struggle, Different Difference that talks about some of these experiences. In your post, you noted similarities from being labeled by society as other, to negotiating disclosure, and to facing barriers and disparities in critical areas of life, saying that the disability community became your community. For those who might not see the connection, what are some of the shared issues that both LGBT people and people with disabilities face?
Thanks, Emmett. Yes, the shared experiences between our communities and our identities, or intersections, as I like to call them, are incredibly numerous. And I really started to notice these commonalities as a very young child. From my earliest thoughts, I knew that I was different, and I was teased and questioned and excluded because of that. And at the time, I thought my difference was something I was going to keep as a secret for the rest of my life. I didn't have a word for being transgender. I didn't have any role models. I didn't have any other friends who were trans. But I looked around and I saw that my classmates with disabilities were being similarly teased, questioned, and excluded because they too looked or acted differently from what was expected. So I not only stuck up with that for them, but I also befriended them, and the disability community really became my community. So these intersections and plight are something not only that I've noticed, but they've brought me to where I am today. So some of the things that I've noticed is that, and this, I've noticed them specifically around the trans and disability communities, but they really cut across the LGBTQ community as well. I said T again there. But at one time or another, we've been labeled by society as other or somehow different from what's normal or desirable. And then our identities have been defined to connote a deviation from what has been determined the normative or majority mind or body, which leads to or can lead to a fascination or discomfort kind of avoidance dynamic. And it also comes along with a history of institutionalization for both communities. And we experience stigma and fear-based attitudes that were somehow not real, not whole, not natural, not capable, gross, threatening, weird-looking. And for some, there can be an association with sin, what a parent might have done wrong to have a child who has a disability, a child who is gender nonconforming, or a child who is gay, lesbian, or queer. We're oftentimes the only people in our families. For people with disabilities, particularly people with hidden disabilities, including people with mental health conditions, people living with HIV, et cetera, and people who are trans, disclosure and coming out is a key issue, one that we have to negotiate almost on a daily basis, especially in places like employment when accessing services. And this process has to be negotiated sensitively in also our social activities like finding a roommate or dating. We experience similar policing within our own communities. Are you trans enough? Are you disabled enough? Our society is built and structured for able-bodied individuals. It's also built around people falling into one camp of man or woman. So you think about every form you fill out, men's or women's, restroom or checkbox. And because of this, we face similar barriers and are excluded from spaces based upon our physical needs or physical presence. Access issues occur in key spaces of life in both of our communities: education, employment, housing, public accommodations, the legal system, medical care, traveling, for example, airport screening. And we've become used to the following societal response to making inclusive policy or programmatic change, or all too often this is the response. Why should we change things for you if it makes the rest of us feel uncomfortable or have to work harder? And then sometimes, though, when changes are made to create equal access or a level playing field, people ask why we need to be given quote-unquote special treatment. Yet, when we make changes for inclusion for one group, it helps all of us. One easy example is curb cuts. Originally, they were built to make streets more accessible for people with disabilities, and now they're used by all of us, including parents pushing strollers, people traveling with luggage. The single-stall bathroom that Ali mentioned is accessible for people with disabilities is often also the one that can be used as a gender neutral bathroom for trans folks. And similarly, I think when providers of services build spaces to be inclusive of and sensitive to trans folks, it's often the case they're going to be more inclusive and sensitive to people with disabilities and vice versa. I was recently given a reference, for example, for a queer and trans-friendly masseuse who also massages people with disabilities and people with body differences generally. That's just one example. And we're also often, unfortunately, more often the victims of bullying as children and violence and violent crimes as adults. And unfortunately, the pressure of nonconformity can lead to self-directed violence as well. And again, we, of course, face similar disparities demonstrated in our high rates of unemployment, poverty, homelessness, etc. But then, of course, there are many, many people with disabilities who themselves are members of the LGBTQ communities and people, members of the LGBTQ communities who are also people with disabilities. And then there's also some interesting, obvious intersections with certain communities like people living with HIV who are both members of the disability community and then the, well, G and T specifically are disproportionately impacted by HIV.
Thank you so much for that. That's a really comprehensive kind of detailed list of just some of the commonalities that these two communities really have. But going beyond shared experiences, what is really currently lacking is easily accessible information about LGBT people with disabilities. In the U.S., nearly 1 in 5 adults has a disability or will experience a disability at some point in their life. It's estimated that between 3 and 5 million Americans with disabilities also identify as LGBT. And the Center for American Progress also found that 14% of LGBT people had received Social Security disability insurance at some point in their lives in the past year. So listening to just how many people exist in both of these marginalized communities, there seems to be a need to address the intersection of identifying as both disabled and LGBT. So my question for you is, what are the biggest issues LGBT people with disabilities face?
First of all, thank you so much for bringing data into the conversation. I have to admit that I've become a bit of a data nerd, but it's because I've witnessed how important data is to bringing about policy change. So having that data about how many people with disabilities identify as LGBTQ and how many who identify as LGBTQ are also people with disabilities is critical to moving forward on these intersections. But as far as the biggest issues that LGBTQ people with disabilities face, I would say that the biggest issue is that they're facing barriers and discrimination from both fronts. I mean, that's probably obvious, but this means that they're more likely to be the subjects of stigma and discrimination, more likely to be unemployed, more likely to be living in poverty, more likely to be homeless, be bullied, and face barriers and other access issues in other areas of life, and particularly people of color within those populations. However, I don't want to focus solely on the barriers. I think being LGBTQ people and people with disabilities also creates access to two wonderful and powerful communities of people and support and the ability to bring these communities together and create changes in policies, practice, and laws that will benefit all of us ultimately.
Yeah, so I think just to echo Dylan, the immense amount of intersections and commonalities between the two communities just goes on and on. And you asked me that question, and I think about the myriad of answers I could give you. Because any issue that the LGBTQ community is working on is inherently a disability issue, because not everyone is able-bodied. The stats are real. We are the largest minority in the country. Now it's 56, I think, million people there are with disabilities. And so at the same time, every issue that the so-called disability community is working on is also an LGBTQ issue, because members of the disability community are LGBTQ. And so whether that be bullying, whether that be incarceration, the disproportionate amount of LGBT and disabled folks who are in the criminal justice system, whether that be both communities, and if you identify as both LGBT and disabled, you are not provided a safe space often from entering the school system to your workplace. And how do you navigate both of them? And I think that it can manifest in both individual interactions. So for me, I identify as queer and disabled. And so in that microcosm of my experience, which is only my experience and is in fact privileged in many ways because I have been provided safe spaces to learn that I can be disabled and proud, to learn that I can be queer and proud, that's rare. That is a privilege. I still have to navigate. I want to go to LGBTQ events, and they're not physically accessible for me. I go to a youth program for youth with disabilities, and I ask preferred gender pronouns of everyone in the room, and there's pushback. Regardless of the fact that there are trans folks in the room with us who are people with disabilities. You ask, what are the issues facing LGBT disabled folks? It's the issues of, it's any civil rights issue.
I really like how you talked about like your individual examples and your experiences. I think sometimes whenever we're in a space that we think is inclusive and geared for justice, sometimes we do forget that we don't know everything and we're not always doing, quote unquote, the right thing. And there's always more we can do. Kaite, do you have anything to add? Any personal experiences with this or any of the work that you've done?
I really appreciate how both Dylan and Allie are touching upon how there's so many different intersections between the disabled and LGBT community. And so it's understanding that if we're talking about adoption and barriers to adoption, we have to talk about disabled LGBT individuals. If we're talking about our education system and bullying and the high amounts in which both of those communities are experiencing bullying, we have to incorporate both of those lens of disability and LGBT. But particularly, I really want to hone in on our criminal justice system. Because on the whole, we see that wrongful conviction, police mistreatment, and overrepresentation of LGBT individuals and disabled individuals is clearly shown and is extremely problematic. And so I think when we're looking at LGBT different individuals, we have to see how does race also complicate these issues. And so looking at criminal justice system, an organization that I really respect and is doing great work is HEARD, or Helping Educate to Advance the Rights of the Deaf, that predominantly focuses on advocating for the deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind individuals. They recently had a campaign called Deaf in Prison, and there was a documentary that was released. And something that I found so moving and so powerful and so eye-opening was how the founder, Talila Lewis, was talking about cultural incompetence and social stigma and how that has led to such immense mistreatment and how this also leads to cyclical poverty insofar as you become, you are led into the criminal justice system. And so I think when we're looking at LGBT disabled individuals, we really have to center racial justice so we can look at how when we combine our identities, it leads to multiple marginalization, and how if we were to center those identities, we would actually have so much more comprehensive and intersectional policy reform.
That's fantastic. And you brought up the point of intersectional identities, which I think kind of leads us into our next question here. At the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the experiences that LGBT people and people with disabilities share. I know Dylan brought up institutionalized discrimination, barriers to services and opportunity. And we've heard from you, Kaite, that there's an increased risk of harassment, violence, and incarceration. I know that a lot of the advocates out there, and especially you three in the room, do a lot of organizing, education, and outreach work that really stresses these intersections of multiple identities and what can happen to people when communities that they are a part of are not welcoming to them. So how can we address ableism in the LGBT community and homophobia or transphobia in the disability community in order to build more inclusive movements? Because if disability justice is an LGBT justice issue, we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can.
I think we really need to understand that when we're talking about disability rights and LGBT rights, that they're the same. And so when I think of this, I think of the slogan, disability rights are human rights, or when people say LGBT rights are human rights. And so I think we have to understand this necessarily means that LGBT disabled rights are also human rights. And so I think in order to encompass that and to bring that into reality, we have to do more cross-training, right, that we are able to understand and articulate the issues of each of our communities. We have to do more leadership and capacity building and center those in the LGBT community who are disabled and the disabled community, those who are LGBT. I think we have to do more coalition building so that we have actual intersectional advocacy. And I think most importantly, we need to show up. We really have to support each other in our movement, and that solidarity cannot just be something on social media. Solidarity also has to be through fundraising, through contributing, through showing up when there's events at the Hill. When I think about how we really address these issues, it's truly about unlearning ableism and unlearning transphobia and homophobia. And so there's so many ways in which I think our advocacy can start to center that. I mean, if we want to talk about homelessness specifically, I think that's an equal front in which we see an overrepresentation of queer homeless youth, as well as people with disabilities who are homeless. And so if we're looking at where's the best place to start, it's really saying, okay, where are some really huge joint issues? And homelessness is one that is pretty loud and clear.
Kaite, you talked a little bit about just showing up. And I was wondering, Allie, if you could tell me a little bit about What would inclusive communities look like to you? What are some concrete steps that folks who are working in disability justice or folks who are working for LGBT rights, what are concrete steps that they can do to make sure that their movements are inclusive as possible?
Yeah, so I think that Kaite touched on a lot of great points in that there are some concepts that both communities so share that can be applied to building more inclusion and diversity and centering those who are multiply marginalized, as Kaite had mentioned. And the first thing that comes to mind is enhancing access for both communities. And so access could mean a variety of different things. It could mean having events in, let's start with the basics, having events in wheelchair accessible places. But I think that the problem is that's often assumed to be it, right? But if you look at the population of people with disabilities, people who use wheelchairs are a very, very, very small number of us. And so how can we expand access to thinking about even on your events, advertising, putting a number and an email for folks to contact you for their access needs? There may be needs for an interpreter. There may be needs for certain lighting, certain large print, all name tags, so many different ways and simple ways that would really enhance new folks, multiply marginalized folks coming to the table. And that is so valuable when we're thinking about not only building inclusion, but also just creating progress for everyone. And also access can go beyond just disability. It can also be trans-related access. Like, let's host our events where there are gender-neutral single-stall bathrooms. Let's be intentional about that. Let's do our research. Let's ask preferred gender pronouns beyond LGBT-specific spaces. Let's start to do that in our disability spaces. And let's normalize that so folks who are trans or genderqueer or non-binary can feel more open about being out, because there are so many trans disabled folks. I mean, you even look at the mental health statistics alone, right? Those are all trans people with mental health related disabilities. And then, you know, I think Kaite makes such a good point in just showing up for one another. That makes such a difference. What does it mean when the organization that I work for, the National Council on Independent Living, what does it mean when they allowed me to go to the Transgender Lobby Day? Because I told them, there are trans people with disabilities. I want to ensure that I know what's going on in policy and to make sure that people with disabilities who are trans are being, and I can serve in definitely only an allyship-related role, but how can we show up for? And unfortunately, I don't think it happens enough. I think that there are a number of things that disability organizations and disability activists can do to be more LGBTQ inclusive. And I think that begins with understanding that committing to LGBTQ equality doesn't start and end with having maybe one or two LGBT folks on your staff. And and this is not claiming any specific example, but I think that this is just more of a general notion. And so what does it mean when a disability organization can sign on to an LGBT related policy, as Dylan had mentioned? Or what does it mean when we take issues like talking about trans identities and we push back on arguments that it's quote-unquote too complex? It's never too complex when folks are being left out. And that is the exact argument that people with disabilities often receive. It's too complex to accommodate you. And so how can we take that concept of breaking down and breaking up with complexity. It's never too complex to include someone. It's never too complex to hear someone's voice. And bring more folks to the table within the disability community that whose lives and voices have so much to teach our movement. And that this not only includes LGBT folks, but LGBTQ people of color, bringing those folks to the table within the disability community, because we know that there's a disproportionate amount of people with disabilities within communities of color, and bringing those folks to the table and bringing LGBTQ folks to the table as well of color to disability communities.
Thank you so much for that. So this July is a big month, I think, for the disability community. This July will mark the 24th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, which was modeled on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Some national LGBT groups have recently come out in favor of a comprehensive civil rights bill to protect LGBT Americans. Dylan, working in the Department of Labor, has probably allowed you to see firsthand how policies like the ADA really impact the lives of people with disabilities. So looking back on almost a quarter of a century of legal protections for people with disabilities, what are some of the victories and challenges of the ADA?
Very good question, Emmett. Well, I first want to say that the ADA was absolutely one of our nation's proudest civil rights triumphs. And it not only changed the law, but it really put disability rights on the map in a new way. And in doing so, it changed hearts, minds, and attitudes. And it also set the standard, and with the ADA Amendments Act, new improvements were made. And other laws, like the historic regulations that were issued under Section 503 of the Rehab Act, rely upon the non-discrimination provisions of the ADA and build upon and reinforce its mandate. Of course, unfortunately, as much progress as we've made under the ADA, we've clearly not met its promise to level the playing field for people with disabilities, and implementation of the letter of the law is ongoing. More people need to know they're protected, and employers and service providers and everyone working with the population need to know what the law covers and expects in terms of equal access for people with disabilities. But like I said before, this is just as much about understanding the bounds of the law, but also impacting hearts, minds, and attitudes, which is really an ongoing piece and is at the crux of access issues, both for people with disabilities and the LGBTQ population.
So I think one of the things that we see, so we have policies like ENDA that have been reviewed, that have had so many changes just to kind of adapt with the changing times. So I think one of the biggest things behind that is how the leadership really interacts and plays a role in making those policies. And so I think today, if we can leave this talk with anything, I think we would want a call to action for what can people do to incorporate disability justice into their LGBT work. One of the most talked about issues in our country right now is about immigration. And it seems like more and more, almost every day, another LGBT organization is supporting immigration as a top priority in their work for justice. We've been hearing leaders and organizations talk about it as an LGBT issue. We've been hearing them talk about equal pay and worker fairness, healthcare, voting rights, all as LGBT issues. The list goes on and on beyond marriage equality. So we've, I think, already affirmed that disability justice is an LGBT issue. But what would you say to organization leaders and advocates who want to make disability a priority in their LGBT work, or to disability rights activists making LGBT justice a priority in their work? What's the first step to move forward on this issue? Kaite, if we could start with you, that would be great.
Certainly. So recently I saw a quote on Facebook that really hit home for me, and it said, "The most dangerous phrase in the human language is we've always done it that way." And so I say this quote because I think it rings true. And I think we have to really challenge ourselves and be intentional about seeing how we can be more intersectional and how we can look at all of our needs and recognizing that we can't leave anybody behind. And so particularly, I think LGBT organizations need to be allies and advocacy and need to listen and need to learn and need to decenter privileged, able-bodied identities at the expense of the disability community. I think throughout this dialogue, both Dylan and Allie have shown us how many issues that we share. And because of that, I think it's bringing it to the table a lens of disability justice and incorporating it and not complicating it. Because truly, none of us can say that we won't be disabled at some point in our life, right? And so understanding this means that people with disabilities are everywhere in our communities and that we can't ignore those needs and that we have to have that lens. And to make sure that a person with a disability or that the needs of the disability community are always at the table.
To continue on with the amazing statement that Kaitay made was, there seems to be a common question within at least within the employment world of where are the people with disabilities? Why can't I hire people with disabilities, especially in the role of youth, finding youth with disabilities to hire? Employers are constantly calling the National Youth Transition Center and asking, where are the youth? And I think that it is clear after this conversation that the youth with disabilities, the adults with disabilities, the older folks with disabilities are here, and their lives and their experiences are real. But we do not create a culture that reverses and unlearns a very problematic concept of disability, that it is something inherently wrong with the body, something inherently wrong with the mind, and that it must be fixed. And so I think there needs to be a cultural shift within non-disability organizations around that disability is not just a medical issue, and that disability can in fact be something that is beautiful, that is as I would quote Kaitay on this call, that is rad, and that disability is innovation, right? So in his words, he says he makes it clear, like, without acknowledging disability as a diversity issue, not just a medical, not just something medically different about an individual, a culture begins to change and people begin to speak up. And so I think that already whatever social justice civil rights organization that exists, there are already people with disabilities at the table, but there's not a safe space to disclose, to talk about it, to see disability beyond an issue of shame. And so how can we alter education, cultural competency to talk about ableism, to call it out? It's not fair that as a 22-year-old, I only learned the oppression that I have experienced my entire life when I was 20. I only learned that word 2 years ago. And what if we didn't have the word racism to talk about racism? What would our environment look like? I mean, we all know that we have so much room to grow, but still, words have power. Calling it out has power, and changing a culture and ideology has power. And so I guess I want to close with a quote by Kim Crosby, who I love as an intersectional activist. And she says, our liberation and resilience is intersectional. It is tied to one another. It is intergenerational. It must be inclusive to folks within the margin, those who are queer, trans, disabled, indigenous, people of color, and undocumented.
Well, I think that all too often it is fear of saying or doing the quote-unquote wrong thing that stops us from taking any action at all, especially when it comes to being an advocacy ally to one another's communities. Ali and Kaitay hit it on the mark in many, many, many ways in terms of what people can do in terms of bringing one another to the table. Sometimes that means literally sending out invitations to, if you're an LGBTQ advocacy group, to the disability leaders, or if you're a disability group, to the LGBTQ org, so that they are there and present, because that will help people recognize those intersections that we were talking about. You can also do things to demonstrate in terms of access and accessibility issues. do things to demonstrate that you are committed to be inclusive of people with disabilities. That might mean some of the things that Ali talked about before, might mean making sure that your website is accessible. If you're a person with a disability and you go to that website and it's not, that says something, and it says something when it is accessible in the other way. Similarly, in terms of physical accessibility and some of the other examples that Ali provided before, I think the disclosure issue that Ali brought up also is incredibly important in terms of people, you know, being out and proud really about all of these statuses. Being out and proud to be trans seems like it's a new thing these days, and people similarly, I hope, will get to the place, and I know that many people are, but we need more people with disabilities to feel comfortable disclosing their disability status if they feel comfortable, because it's also a privileged place to be able to be out and proud, and not everybody wants to disclose their status. But that's a shared a place where there's more and more discussion around how we can get people to feel comfortable disclosing. And the way that you get people to feel comfortable disclosing, which then changes the culture, is to build workplaces and other environments that are inclusive and demonstrate inclusion. So there's a lot that you can do in that regard. I think as a very practical step, if the leaders of and staff of disability orgs just take concerted action to set up a meeting with, you know, some local LGBTQ groups, or if they want to focus on the trans population with the local trans groups, whatever it may be, just to have an initial conversation around what the different organizations' priorities are and where the intersections are. I can't say enough how powerful it is to me when I see a disability organization sign on to a letter for a LGBTQ issue and vice versa. It's so incredibly powerful. And since we're ending with quotes, the one that always resonates with me is a quote by Bishop Eugene Robinson, who said that we all exist in these silos, and the oppressors want us to remain in those silos, and imagine how powerful we would be if we all came together.
I want to thank Dylan Orr, Ali Cannington, and Kaite Davidson for taking the time to talk with us today. Thank you all for all the awesome work you're doing and for sharing your experiences with us. And with advocates like you leading the way and fearlessly sharing their stories, we continue to work towards a nation where all people not only dream of the possibility to get an education, to feel safe in the workplace, to access healthcare, but actually get the opportunity to do so. And we look to change the culture so that we can truly embrace our identities as LGBT people, as people with disabilities, and people of multiple identities, so that we have the space and opportunity to live out authentically and proud. Thanks for listening.